You're listening to Clause 8, the voice of IP. On today's episode, Matteo Sabatini.
I have a friend who has an IoT company, and some time ago he got approached by a licensor, and he immediately picked up the phone and called me. You gotta help me, I don't know what to do. There's, you know, why me? Why are they targeting me? What's going on? And how do I respond? And so on and so forth. And my answer was like, well, my friend, first of all, calm down, then go down to the cellar, pick a good bottle, open it and drink it, because you gotta celebrate. Because if they approach you, it means you're doing something right. you're probably profitable, you're probably growing, you're probably in a position that actually you are on the radar, which means that you're doing something right.
Clause 8 is part of IP Watchdog and sponsored by Harrity, the go-to firm for the Patent 300 for patent preparation and prosecution. After you're done listening to this episode, please leave us a review wherever you're listening now and give us a 5-star rating. It really helps others find the show. Thank you. And now here's your host, Eli Mazur.
Today, we're lucky to be joined by Matteo Sabatini, all the way from Italy. If you know about the DC patent space, you probably know from his longtime passionate advocacy as director of IP policy for Ericsson. But he's now in a new role as president and chief licensing officer for Convida. Matteo, thank you so much for joining Clause 8.
Eli, thank you for having me. Pleasure to be here. Looking forward to this conversation.
So what is Convida?
So Convida was founded more than 10 years ago, initially born as a joint venture between InterDigital and Sony to, in essence, complement the expertise that both InterDigital had in R&D, in the telecom space and wireless space, and Sony's consumer electronics expertise. Convida has really driven research in IoT communications and other connectivity areas since its inception. The idea is really to bring connectivity everywhere and build a fully connected world through technologies that enable service layer network functionalities. In essence, if you wish, it builds the fabrics that connects app developers, cloud platforms, telco providers to the actual physical layer, to the actual devices, through this service layer. Convida has invested substantial resources, both financial as well as more than 400,000 hours in R&D. And as I said, it spanned more than 10 years of R&D, and we continue to do R&D in areas that, again, are very complementary and not overlapping what both InterDigital and Sony are doing. I've been called to, you know, lead this venture as we move to the next phase, as we look at ways to, you know, monetize the technologies that were invented and go to the next phase and start, you know, doing more R&D, thanks to a virtuous cycle that can be ignited by licensing our technologies to those who are using our technologies.
Can you give us a little bit of sense why Sony, which is obviously one of the largest companies in the world, and InterDigital, I guess, you know, obviously as a successful licensor, why were they even interested in their times and energies on forming something like this? What was the impetus for that?
What I know for sure is that there is a strong commitment by both of them, as there was 10 years ago, to continue doing R&D, again, in areas that are in IoT-centric, but not directly related to the R&D that already both InterDigital and Sony are doing. There was a recent article, I think it was on IM, was an interview to Tosh Mitomo, which is, you know, one of the executives at Sony, and he was previously, I think, the head of their IP department before moving up even higher. And in that interview, Tosh highlighted how, you know, Sony is always interested in looking at ways to build partnership and really do licensing and IP and development in partnership through JV or other avenues. So this is not new for Sony. This was already true 10 years ago. And again, I'm grateful to be in, you know, put in charge of this this venture now that, again, it's a fully independent venture, but we have some very noble starting and certainly some very committed shareholders as we move forward.
What is part of the company? Do you have your engineers, or who is doing the research and development?
Yeah, R&D was done internally through a combination of consulting, R&D agreements, and other things, and internal R&D that was done on this service layer area. This is how the company has operated so far. This is the intention that I have going forward to continue doing this pretty intense and groundbreaking R&D. But certainly, it's an expensive and resource-intensive endeavor. And so it does require certainly committed investors, but also going to, as I said, the next phase as to how can we unlock the value of what was created so far to unlock even more innovation. I think it's common for certainly large R&D companies, but even more important for small R&D companies. If we want to continue this innovation trend, patent licensing becomes potentially one very important area to recoup some of those investments, but even more importantly, keep investing in what comes next. In essence, continue doing what we do next, which is really creating technologies that will be used and will benefit society and consumers down the road. I don't know if that answered your question, right? Maybe, as I said, something that could shed some light on what Convida has done is a little bit of history and how we got where we are. Most of the R&D was done on a standard, actually, the development of a standard that was called 1M2M. And it was an Etsy standard. It is an Etsy standard. It is a standard out there. And so that's how most of the R&D was developed. That standard, unfortunately, didn't really gain market traction for different reasons.
What is a standard for?
The standard was basically trying to build, again, a standardized service layer that would connect, what I said, apps and telco providers to the actual devices, right? Let me give you some simple examples of what that service layer could be. There are security aspects when you communicate to devices in the IoT space, right? Or there is a need to build a digital version of that device that you're actually accessing on the physical layer. And those things can be abstracted in ways that can be somewhat reused across verticals, right? You don't have to reinvent every time what needs to be done to access a specific IoT device if you go to a slightly different IoT device, right? That was the idea of 1M2M.
From the consumer's perspective, every time you get a new device or a new app or something like that, it's a whole new world, right? So I guess the idea was to kind of standardize that and or at least how they communicate right now.
Right, exactly. That didn't gain market traction. There are multiple reasons. One of the reasons is that really the big cloud infrastructure providers out there were not particularly interested in a standardized version because they're looking at their own proprietary solutions to sort of lock consumers in, right? And you can think of the big platform, but there are also smaller, more niche vertical platforms as well out there. Despite that, a lot of the technologies that were developed in that context ended up in proprietary solutions. And to me, that sort of proves two things. Proves the quality of the R&D that was done by Convida. By the way, Convida was the lead contributor to that 1M2M standard. And number two, it shows that something that sometimes get really mistaken in the public opinion, technologies that end up in a standard do so and are included in a standard because they're good technologies to begin with. They solve a need. They solve a problem. Sometimes people think that the opposite is quite true, which means that a technology that makes it into a standard magically becomes a more valuable technology. That's far from reality, right? Generally speaking, of course, there could always be exceptions. Generally speaking, a development of a standard needs to solve certain solutions, and the technologies that are chosen to be in that standard are those that are most helpful to solve that solution. And so that's how, a lot of standards work. And it's not unheard of that, standards don't gain market traction, and yet those technologies are valuable technologies and make it into the market somewhere else, right? And this is one example.
No, I think that's very interesting. I think the point you highlight is that just because there's a standard doesn't mean everybody has to use it, something you often hear. And the value of innovations that may be represented by what somebody might call standard essential patents, they're valuable because those were good good ideas, not because they made it to a standard. So I think that's important to highlight. You know, one of the things we were discussing is, you know, the debate, I guess, about who should be, I guess, paying for these, or discussion about who should be paying for these innovations. Where in the supply chain, and you mentioned, you know, sometimes the value of some of the innovations that you kind of described is really not whatever the gadget is that might use it, but it's really the service that's being provided thanks to those innovations. How are you thinking about that?
One needs to always think in terms of efficiency, right? Where is the most efficient attachment point for different technologies, either standardized or not? And what makes the most sense also from from a value to the consumer point of view? I guess there has been a lot of talks recently as to whether, talking about connectivity, standard essential patents, for example, the attachment points should go up the supply chain and more into the module manufacturers or even chip manufacturers, right? And that discussion, I think, is sort of moot and becomes less relevant, especially if you look at the success that, for example, some pools, I'm thinking of Avanci, for example, has had in actually licensing the car manufacturers and showing that actually efficiencies can be achieved through that attachment point. But I mean, the opposite could also be thought, right? I mean, there could be reasons for going downstream in the supply chain and more on the, you know, application services and those attachment points. Again, it depends on the technology. In terms of value to the user, the IoT is vast, right? The IoT is very different, it's very diverse. There are a lot of devices that can be very significantly different. A car is very different from a smart meter, right? And so where that value is to the consumer depends on which vertical you're looking at. But, you know, thinking in abstract, there are areas where potentially the value is shifting from the actual device to, as you said, more of the services and the platform. An example that I sometimes bring up is the following. I recently bought a very clever little connected device, which is basically a mechanical finger that can switch a switch, that can turn on and off a switch, and can be connected through Wi-Fi. I have an old furnace in the house, so I had I faced the problem of figuring out a way to get it connected, and I couldn't really do anything unless I changed the furnace. And when I ran into this little device, I thought that could be an option, right? At least remotely, I can turn on and off when I need it. That device was probably $20, right? It's very clever, but it's very cheap. It's very simple. It does one thing, turns one switch on and off, right? The value for me of that device is the fact that now I can control it via Alexa. I can connect it to my smart thermostat. Create IFFT routines that actually do things with that little switch and therefore with my furnace based on other things that happen in my connected environment. So that's really where the value to me comes in, right? Not into the device itself. So that can be true in other verticals, and that's something that we need to recognize when talking about efficiencies and attachment points and licensing.
So in that example that you gave, and you said it makes sense from a efficiency standpoint, the way I understand it is that the company that can make the payment on behalf of the most on behalf of the most consumers or whatever, it would make sense for that company to pay for that innovation. Is that what you kind of mean? Like in that example that you provided for that furnace switch, is it the company that's providing that platform to which all the IoT devices are connecting? Is that the?
Well, I'm hinting at two separate matters here. One is the value to consumer, right? And to me, the value to consumer determines the value of the technology, right? Because ultimately, you cannot determine how valuable a technology is if you don't have a sense of how valuable that technology is to a user, to a consumer, right? That's why I always found the discussion about module taking a license kind of interesting, but sort of missing the point, because one thing is attachment point. The other thing is value of the technology, right? And so regardless of who takes a license, the value of the technology should be calculated to the value to the user. So that's point number one. Point number two, attachment point and efficiency really depends.
And then, sorry, just to clarify, because there's the economic debate is some people think it's the smallest component whatever, it's like the smallest component within the device that you can attribute to that innovation to, that's what I guess the licensing royalty should stem from, right? And you're saying that that's not really the right way to look at that, because whatever you, even if you find some clever way to attach it to like a, a small microchip within your phone, it's really the whole phone wouldn't be able to function without that. Or I guess the benefit to the consumer wouldn't.
Right. You're hinting at SSPPU, which is really a valuation method to determine the value of the technology that uses the, as SSPPU stands for, the smallest saleable practicing unit. And that's a fallacy, right? Because you cannot actually determine the value of a technology at all from a chipset that is not connected to anything, not connected to a network, not connected to battery, not connected to anything. There was, I think, an analogy that a judge made in the past that was basically, he looked at the SSPPU as a tool and said that it would be like valuing the value of a book from the cost of the paper, the ink, and the binding, right? That misses the point. That really misses the point. And in addition, there isn't really anything that a chipset alone can do for a user, right? It needs to be connected somehow. So that's the valuation part, and this is the SSPPU. The other part is the attachment point, so where you actually license your patents. And that fundamentally depends on the claims, right? You can't license claims that are not infringed, and therefore how the claim reads on, you know, wherever you're trying to get in the supply chain. But there is also an efficiency point, right? Whether, you know, you license at one level or at another, it might make more sense to license at one level because you have less licensees or because it's easier to track, right? One problem with licensing a modular chipset is the fact that you then lose track of where those modules and chipset go. And so you have a very hard time in figuring out in different verticals where this chipset end up, right? One thing is if they go into a phone, very different thing is if they go into a smart meter, right? Those are two drastically different verticals, right?
Going back to Convita for a second, this is kind of returning to your roots from what I understand, you know, before your role at Ericsson, you were involved in the technology and the licensing side, hands-on. I mean, now that you're in this new role, is there, assuming obviously you have valuable technology that others are using, what makes a licensing program successful in terms of making sure that licensees are happy to pay you royalties and so forth? I guess what can a licensor do that to make that happen?
Yeah, I think big part of it is really making sure that we can communicate the value that we're adding, right? And that we have added through our R&D. And I'm very confident that we will, because knowing our engineers and knowing our portfolio, we have clearly added value. I think what makes a licensing program successful, in my mind, is a licensing program that looks forward to how, you know, creating a licensing program can fuel. And that can fuel further innovation, either directly because you have R&D and the licensing program, or indirectly because that licensing program is bringing in revenue that then can be reinvested by, for example, the investors that are behind that patent portfolio elsewhere. To me, that's the fundamental thing. And in terms of licensee-licensor dynamic, I think ultimately, you know, we need to get to a point where we're rather than maybe both happy of the agreement, maybe both equally unhappy, in the sense that we figure out a balance that makes sense for the licensor to continue that innovation and for the licensee to really determine that that's the value that attributable to the portfolio. And a big part of it, I think, is also communicating that value, making sure that people understand the technology, and therefore it becomes crucial to have, you know, visibility into that R&D and into the people that have fueled that R&D. I think a little too often we run into the mistake of thinking of patent licensing as a tax to innovation, which is actually quite the opposite, because it's a way to actually fuel that innovation. And we too often look at patents as, piece of papers when they're not piece of papers. Those are hard work and sweat by engineers and innovators. And that's the recognition, right? And so licensing is a means, if you wish, to fuel more of that innovation. No, there is a big debate around litigation financing and IP-backed financing right now. And some folks are trying to paint that as fundamentally negative or, something that doesn't help society, and it is actually a cost because it fuels or it pays for NPEs and patent trolls, etc. I think that's a fundamental mistake because litigation financing or IP-backed financing in general is sometimes the only way that smaller inventors, smaller companies can in fact make sure that their innovation is respected and their patents are respected, and so that they can continue doing that innovation. As I said, it doesn't matter to me if that financing goes to a patent portfolio that doesn't have R&D, because ultimately, if that generates revenue because it's a good patent portfolio, that brings more money that can be reinvested by those folks who invested in that specific deal or others elsewhere, right? And ultimately create more innovation. And more innovation is good for society, period.
Yeah, an important part of telling that story about your innovation, obviously on a practical sense, if you're going to enforce a license patent portfolio, you need patents. I mean, what do you think about, how do you think about building a patent portfolio that is truly representative of that R&D and kind of helps you tell that story and helps you accomplish the goal of getting a return on that R&D? Any thoughts about that?
Yeah, so I find one thing that is very important is actually to have a feedback loop between the licensing department and the prosecution department. And oftentimes, therefore, the prosecution attorneys, who are often the outside attorneys. I think that's fundamentally something that savvy, IP-savvy companies already do, but not all. The other thing that I find very important is to make sure that internally, the C-level suite understands the value of that R&D and the value created through that R&D and of the patent portfolio. Again, IP-savvy companies already have those systems in place, but you'd be surprised, right? There are large companies that still lack some of those systems. But in general, I think we need to work more on the awareness at C-level suite by CEOs, by CFOs, of what the licensing department does and what the R&D department does together, right? And that's where I think we need a lot more work to be done. You'd be surprised, even in large organizations that place a big weight on the patent department, oftentimes their CFOs or CEOs don't really understand the value of their portfolio. Oftentimes the chief IP officer doesn't even report directly to the CEO. And that's bizarre, right? That's not what companies that have vast, solid, and valuable patent portfolio should do to increase the value of those assets. And I'm talking about patents, but that's really in general on the whole IP owned by a company. I would even go beyond IP. I would mention the intellectual capital as a broader term that goes well beyond IP, because it encompasses the people that you have and the know-how of the people and so on. I think there is more work that needs to be done to sort of cross that divide between the C-suite and the IP departments.
Obviously you want everybody to be a willing licensee who's using your technology, but I'm guessing you've been doing it too long to kind of assume that's the case. I mean, as part of your licensing approach, companies change their approach internally, right? Some companies, they go from being companies that are willing to license, and then they decide to play more hardball and then go the other way. As you're building a licensing program, how do you take that into account? What do you do to kind of prepare for litigation, but try to avoid it?
So I'll answer that in two ways. The first one is, I am confident that because of the value of our portfolio and the value of our R&D, that we will start having meaningful conversations with all licensees pretty quickly. And I expect and suspect that we will have, again, meaningful conversations with licensees who are willing to engage because of the value that we bring to the table. The second part of my answer is probably not necessarily looking at what Comvita will be doing, but more based on my experience and my past experience, right? Ending up in court is not necessarily an indication of bad faith on either side. It's actually something that happens all the time, right? There are commercial discussions that sometimes break down, and you know, the courts are the way to address those, right? And in fact, in my experience, there has been a number of instances where, despite the fact that we were in litigation, the licensing discussions never stopped. And we actually were trying to make progress on both sides, right? Despite the fact that we were in court. And then there are other scenarios where it's pretty evident that you know, licensing discussions will break down, and litigation is probably the only way forward. And that's fine. That's why we have the courts, right? What I think is something that, as a community, as an innovation ecosystem, we should think about is the toll on innovation of truly unwilling licensees who refuse to negotiate and end up refusing basically to take licenses that others have already taken, and drag licensors in litigation for many, many years, right? Litigation is costly. We're talking about global licenses, so litigation is often global in many jurisdictions. And if a large company faces a large company, that's one thing. But if a small company faces a larger company, that's certainly an issue, right? And how do you address that? One fundamental issue that I have, especially in the friend space, is the fact that sometimes it's just the most efficient thing to do for a licensee to drag their feet, because even after years and years of litigation, they end up paying the friend rate, what everybody else paying, right? And that's, to me, a fundamental issue with some of the court cases, some of the, sometimes how people look at friend. I think the moment that you are found to be unwilling, you wish, and I'm not even sure that friend would apply to an unwilling licensee, right? Because that licensee is basically taking advantage of a system and is also taking an advantage vis-a-vis those competitors who have actually taken a license early. So that's something that I hope we'll try to address as a community at some point, because that's costly for licensors, and especially for smaller companies like Comvita or other smaller companies. It becomes pretty daunting to think of the prospect of going into litigation for years and years and years worldwide.
So do you think this is something that standard bodies should be thinking about into putting in terms of agreements when innovators participate in developing standards, that they're going to be having to deal with unwilling licensees, that there should be different terms than if it's a willing licensee?
I think standard bodies should do what they do best, which is create great standards with great technologies. And they should focus on that. They should remain focused on the technical matters. To be completely frank, however, friend policies, for example, take the Etsy friend policy, already take into account the fact that friend is, in Huawei ZTE's word, a two-way street, right? There is a licensor or a patent owner that owns patents that are essential, potentially essential to the standard, but then there is an implementer who's willing to negotiate and take a friend license, right? It takes two to tango, right? So the SDOs are already recognizing that that's what's supposed to happen. But as I said, I think SDOs should focus on the technology, on creating and bringing good technologies to market. I think there's got to be a recognition also from the courts that these are global licenses with sometimes a very large number of patents at stake, and you cannot litigate all of your patents. You only can litigate a handful of patents, and so even treble damages cannot possibly cover the damages that are really accrued by someone who's not taking a license to a global portfolio. So there's got to be some recognition by courts, by judges, by tribunal, that, you know, those treble damages don't, they're not sufficient, that in general, damages alone are not sufficient, right? And injunctions are probably the only way to really level the playing field and make sure that the truly unwilling licensees come to the table and negotiate.
As we're talking today, you're wearing a, I hope you don't mind me mentioning it, USSD sweatshirt. That's where you got your PhD in communication theory and systems. How did you end up in dealing with patents? What was your, do you remember the first time you heard about patents?
I do remember that, and it was way too late into my technical education, which, again, is something that we should address at some point, right? How do we make sure that if you go through engineering school, you're actually exposed to what patents are and why they're important and what intellectual property is in general? I think that too many students in technical disciplines don't get enough exposure to what the patent system is and how patents are. But that's maybe for a different podcast. How did I get exposed? It was relatively serendipitous in the sense that, you know, I was getting tired of academic research, and probably I wasn't very good at it either. I don't know, or both. And I decided, because someone mentioned it, that I could take a look at technical analysis of patents, and I started doing that. And I liked it mainly because I liked the diversity, really, getting exposed to that many technologies and getting to learn new things from what others had patented. And to me, that sort of opened the door to the patent system. But more importantly, it sort of opened my mind to the fact that until then, I was trained to write papers, and patents were actually something that could be done in parallel and should be done in parallel. And I think universities now are understanding that much better than when at least I went to my PhD many decades ago. The two things are not antithetical. In fact, they could complement one another. And if you have a good idea that can be patented and can be published, you should do both, because a publication can actually help spreading that technology and therefore making your patent potentially more valuable. Right? I think savvy tech transfer offices understand that. Not all of them yet, but we're making some progress. So I went off a tangent, but to answer your question, how do I get into the patent war? That was the first step. And then I moved more and more into the business side of things and moved into the deal making. And that's basically the rest of history.
So you joined Siswell, which has been somewhat in the pan news today recently because of some Federal Circuit decisions, but it's a big, somewhat of a pioneer in IP licensing and patent pools in Europe. And was coincidentally, I think, started in Italy, but you joined in its DC office in 2009. How did you end up joining them? Did it have anything to do with its Italian roots, where your shared Italian roots?
Well, you'd be surprised how many IP professionals there are that come from Italy. You know, and certainly Roberto Dini, who's the founder of Siswell, was one of the pioneers in this space, right?
I'm actually reading a book now. It's called Once Upon a Time, a Patent Story. And I was planning to speak more about it, but all the beginning stories take place in Italy because that's where the innovation was taking place. So.
Well, you'd be surprised, actually. The first patent system was actually the Statute of Venice in the 13th century. That's where the first patent system actually was born, right? And even only a few centuries later, the Medici in Florence were encouraging inventors to actually protect their inventions and potentially monetize them. Brunelleschi was one of them, right? So yes, there is certainly a lot of history there of innovation in Italy. Why Siswell and what Siswell has done in this past few decades, really, because they've been around for many decades. As I said, I think Roberto Dini was a pioneer in what he did, first in, you know, licensing technologies defensively, then licensing technologies more to recoup investments, and then moving into patent pools. I think Siswell has been able to really navigate the evolving patent landscape in the sense that they really changed their way of approaching the market. They've created new programs. They've been quite successful in making jurisprudence, if you wish. And so kudos to them, to what they have done. I'm happy I could contribute to some extent when I was with them. It's certainly an organization worth watching, and they're doing something right because they've been around for many decades.
And, you know, you see a lot of companies trying to enter the space or new models or new ideas. You mentioned Avanci, which has been, I think, seems super successful at what they're doing. Is there anything in your lessons that you took from Siswell or now taking from Avanci about what works and doesn't work in terms of trying to create new models to license technology and license?
Well, I would say, and this is maybe for regulators that I say this, that Avanci, Siswell, and other platforms and other licensing methods sort of prove that that industry-led solutions do work for the industry. And so I understand the appetite to regulate, but at the same time, I think that appetite to regulate needs to be data-driven. And if data shows that a market is functioning efficiently and given enough time, the industry can self-regulate itself, then probably regulation is just would be over-regulating to go and put a thumb on the scale. That to me, what at least the recent success of Avanci and Siswell and other patent pools show is that patent pools are one way to solve sometimes market needs. Not always. Bilateral licensing also works quite effectively and has worked quite effectively in a number of verticals. Our phones keep getting cheaper and keep getting faster. So that probably works quite well. That's basically what I think, one of the lessons learned. What didn't work, I'm not going to go into the specific, but I think one thing that actually helps in our industry is what we were discussing before, that feedback that you always get by negotiating with licensees if you're a licensor, or with negotiating with licensors if you're a licensee, or with both if you're both, right? And many companies are both licensees and licensors. I think that inevitably brings a lot of knowledge into the ecosystem and helps solving problems and becoming more efficient as time goes by. That is true for pool administrators that talk to licensors and licensees and adapt based on what they learn. But it's true for anybody in our industry, and that I think is the beauty of this industry, which to some could seem to be overly litigious. But ultimately, it's just commercial matters, and you end up in court sometimes. That's inevitable. But there is a lot of shared knowledge, and it's ultimately a tight, small community that work very well together. We all know one another, right?
So after Siswell, you you became a director of IP policy for Ericsson. You don't have the background of a typical DC lobbyist. How did you, I guess, end up in that role for Ericsson?
Yeah, how did I end up not being the typical lobbyist? And again, I'm hopefully taking that as a compliment. Although I know a lot of very good lobbyists that do a tremendous job in DC on the Hill. So I guess not being a lawyer is probably a little peculiar. Being in the policy space, I really started my policy activities. And by the way, I never stopped doing licensing. Even at Ericsson, I was doing both licensing and policy. But how did I start with the policy space? I was back at Siswell, and I recognized that, in my opinion, the policy debate was A, polarized, and B, often focusing on the theory. The theory of hold up, the theory of patent trolls, the theory of NPEs, and so on.
Is there something that happened that made you focus on policy?
There is. If you remember back, and not even remember what year, the IEEE was discussing and eventually enacted a policy change, which was, I have to admit, quite unsuccessful for IEEE in the sense that it really created a lot of friction and a lot of unwanted confusion. Right? I've been an IEEE. An IEEE member for as long as I can remember. And I care about IEEE because I think it's a great engineering organization. I'm a senior member. I've been a senior member for a long time. I joined as a student. So I've been with IEEE for decades. That patent policy change was, as I said, certainly questionable. And that, to me, was the spark that really gave me a reason to look more at what was happening in the policy debate, starting from patent policies discussions at SDOs, right? That I actually believe was first, but then a lot of other SDOs had regular discussions around their patent policy. I also, what motivated me was, as I said, I thought at some point that there was too much theory in the debate and not a whole lot of practical discussions by those in the trenches, those who actually do the deals, those who actually do the negotiations. I think we got better in the past few years. We have more licensing experts going into policy discussions because they ultimately bring those skills, right? Bring the practicalities, the efficiencies, the reality check, right? That if you only look at the theory, you inevitably miss.
When you took on that role of director of IP policy, in certain ways, it was like the low point for America's patent system. People were hoping it would get better. What did you think you needed to do to be successful on behalf of Ericsson, obviously, which is now primarily known, I guess, in these debates as an innovator and a licensor?
Well, again, Ericsson is a big licensor, but it's also a big licensee, right? They're a big manufacturer like many other companies. You're right. I was at Ericsson probably in what some people define as the dark times of IP. What needed to be done and what I think the community has done relatively successfully, at least in the US, is to sort of fend off the attacks by the Cassandras that keep repeating that the system is not working, that things are opaque and there is no transparency and it's very, very difficult to figure out how to get a license to, you know, the many patents that are oftentimes invalid and all those arguments that we hear over and over, right? Which, you know, they make the news, they certainly make for good titles of articles, and they've invented some words that stuck, like patent troll, etc. But they're unfortunately not based on data and based on reality. Right? The reality is that the market is actually functioning quite effectively and quite efficiently for, you know, from any angle you look at it, right? At least in the telecommunication space, there is convergence. Technology is getting into pretty much any vertical, from automotive to smart meters to, you know, mechanized fingers. Right. There is an explosion of new use cases from telemedicine through 5G to asset tracking and so forth. Right? Users are spending less per gigabyte. Right? They have newer phones with more functionalities and so on. So that, to me, when I took that role, was the data. And then there were, as I said, the Cassandras that kept telling, you know, a gloomy story of tax on innovation, of how we could be further ahead in innovation if we didn't have to pay patent royalties or if we didn't have NPEs and that story.
And who do you think is the most important audience for that? Who do you think was the most important audience for your message? Is it on Capitol Hill? Is it in USPTO?
Yeah, it's a combination, really. I think, you know, it's a combination of pretty much anybody who deals with innovation. I think one thing that we haven't been yet very effective at communicating, at least on the Hill, is how you tie innovation with IP. Because if you ask anyone on the Hill, do you support innovation? The answer is obvious. It's yes, right? But then if you drill one level down and you're like, okay, but how do you actually support that innovation? What should we do to support that innovation? Then you get very different responses and sometimes very misguided responses that don't take into consideration the importance of IP to fuel that innovation.
Well, some of the arguments that we heard it around COVID time was that actually patent rights and IP rights get in the way of innovation, which... Did anybody or any, I guess, on either side of patent policy debates stand out to you as being particularly effective in D.C., where you're like, wow, they're good at what they do?
Well, I don't know if I want to name names, because if I do that, I'm sure that I'll forget some. I mean, there are a lot of people that have been extremely instrumental in pushing the right message to the Hill and to other fora. And you're one of them. I mean, this podcast has certainly been a way to get that message out. I would say that there are a lot of associations that do a lot of good work as well. There are a lot of individuals that do incredible work, both academics, former judges, and journalists. Right. I think that community has been very effective in some areas. One thing that we should think about is really how do we get together and how do we try to coalesce around good policy messages as well as good results for the IP ecosystem. I sometimes see a little bit of not division, but going in different direction because there isn't a clear objective. I can give you a few examples, right? It's sometimes when you talk about the IP debate, you tend to talk in silos, right? There is the pharma group, then there is the iTech group, and then there is the small inventor group, and too often there is not a whole lot of interaction and communication between those silos. I think we can get better at that because ultimately the issues are the same issues for all of us. And the other thing that I would say is that it's really important also to determine and for regulators who they're talking to, because sometimes it strikes me as odd that there are associations that represent or claim to represent certain interest groups, for example, small and medium enterprises, and yet if you go under the hood, they're not really representing those small and medium enterprises, right? And so that's something important to recognize.
So that's an example, I think, of a probably an effective tactic, right? By the other side.
It certainly is. It certainly is. Now, the last thing I'd say, I think in the US, we're seeing a few pro-patent bills that are actually quite good. And again, I think that the patent communities should coalesce and recognize that these are good steps in the right direction. They're not perfect. Nothing is perfect. Nothing that comes out of the of Capitol Hill is perfect because it's inevitably a compromise. But they're better than the status quo, and they're going in the right direction. And so I find it odd sometimes to hear from supposedly pro-patent advocates that they're opposing these bills because they don't go far enough, because they're not perfect. That might be true. If we were alone in a room and coming out with a bill, we might go further than those bills. But the reality is that they're actually very good, at least in terms of changing the direction that we've been going into.
When you stepped into your role at Ericsson, one of the things that happened before that time was the 2013 policy statement, where the administration at the time said that injunctions and ITC exclusion orders might not be appropriate for standard central patents. And then you saw the next administration kind of take the reverse position. And then finally, 2021, the current administration withdrew those policy statements altogether. I mean, what was the practical impact, if any, of those policy statements? Why were the debates about them so heated in the US?
Yeah, so I think, the original policy statement, the one that is no more because there is no longer any policy statement, the issues that I had with that statement were a few, but the idea, at least behind the statement, was to have something relatively narrow, although not great, because it was really narrowly focusing on ITC. And granted that it was not a good idea to limit injunctions in the ITC in my mind, but that was the way that statement was supposed to be read. Unfortunately, it got read much, much broader. So one of the reasons that, for example, the IEEE supported that policy change was, they used that statement as pointing as if the U.S. government was going in the same direction, in essence, making sure that injunctions were never available for standard essential patents. That was not, again, the intention of the statement, but that's the way that it was read. The other thing that I find very, very odd and dangerous of a policy statement coming from the US that goes in the opposite direction of innovation is the possibility that those statements and those ideas could be borrowed by other countries, right? And in particular, maybe by countries that have more of an interest in protecting their internal market as opposed to protecting innovation in general. So that's what was odd about that policy statement. You know, I think both the following administration that actually revised that policy statement and this administration who decided to actually pull out of all policy statements, those were both good decisions, right? Because the fact that the revised policy statement came out sort of set the record, right? In essence, saying there is no difference between ICPs and a patent. Injunctions are still there. And, you know, there are many tests and rules and ways that judges should determine whether an injunction should issue or not, right? And the last administration to actually withdraw from all of the policy statement also, I think, is a good idea because at least it avoids the possibility that, you know, we keep flip-flopping policy statements forever, right? Which is also not great for the industry, right?
Director Kev, that was on Clause 8. You know, that's the reason she gave for withdrawing was that she said she was getting feedback from American companies that in discussions abroad, other jurisdictions were pointing to these policy statements for forming their own rules, and that's why she decided to withdraw. But then we thought we were done with this debate, at least some of us who weren't looking too closely. And then the European Commission proposes this whole new set of rules, I think effectively rein in innovators. And now people in the U.S. are pointing to that and saying, well, look what happens. You know, America abandoned its leadership role and now Europe is stepping in. What do you think drove those European Commission draft proposals? What do you think will happen with them?
Yeah, what was the sort of determining factor as to deciding to issue that draft proposal? I don't know. I don't have the insights of that. What I can say is that one of the at least motivation of this draft coming out of DG Grow, and DG Grow is the director general that is, you know, caring more about small and medium enterprises, was precisely to help SMEs navigate what they see being a very complex ecosystem, right or wrong. I don't know. I think that was one of the motivation, right?
Before came out with these draft proposals, were you hearing that story being told in Europe that SMEs are having trouble navigating?
Yeah, it was definitely something that I've heard quite often, not only in Europe, right? Again, unfortunately, sometimes those kind of statements came out of associations that are not really representing SMEs, which I find quite odd, right? And that's not helpful in the debate, right? But yes, certainly there is a lot of attention on SMEs in general in Europe and in other jurisdictions. And that is something that has been used quite often as a reason to point to the need for regulation to help SMEs. I think that you know, that misses the point in a few ways, right? First of all, it completely forgets that there are SMEs who are actually innovating. Combida is one of them, right? But there are many, many out there. There are many in Europe, and there are many everywhere. And they innovate in different ways, and some innovate in standardized technologies, some innovate in other areas, some innovate in medical, some innovate in high tech, and some innovate through patents, others innovate in other ways, right? But ultimately, there are a lot of SMEs that innovate. And in fact, I would claim that without small companies and inventors, a lot of the innovation that we know today would not exist, right? And the big companies do innovate, but in different ways, right? And oftentimes the most agile companies are those who actually bring the newest technologies to the market, right? And I'm not, if we don't look at high tech for a second, look at mRNA, right? The technology behind the COVID vaccine that came out of, you know, small research groups and small companies, right? So that's an amazing innovation if you think about it. So it misses the mark because we often forget about those SMEs, right? And those are certainly not helped by the DG Grow proposal at all, because the DG Grow proposal doesn't even put them on the map at all. They don't even consider that there are those SMEs. And the other thing that misses the mark on the SMEs is that really is not helping SMEs at all, because it doesn't really create a system that makes somewhat easier for an SME to figure out who to talk to. It ultimately only helps bigger companies, if you think about it. And that's really the concern that I have with that proposal.
And how do you think it's playing out?
Well, I unfortunately think that there is an appetite to regulate, and we passed the point as to, will there be regulation or not? I think that there is an interest in doing something, which to me is always a little dangerous, right? Because you should first determine if you need to do something before you move, right? That's at least as chess players always think. And yet here we see a lot of entropy without, in my opinion, a very clear direction. And if you think about it, I don't know who thought it was a good idea to put the trademark office in charge of an SEP system, right? A standard essential patent system. That makes not a whole lot of sense. So to answer your question, I think that there is certainly appetite to do something. In my opinion, this draft legislation is not actionable in the sense that it's there are a lot of issues with it. Even if you read it, there are so many typos, so many missing definitions, and I have no idea, even if this becomes a law, how the EUIPO, the European Trademark Office, will ever go by and implement such a thing. I recently published a small article where I threw out a small idea that maybe could be more helpful to SMEs than this regulation. And the basic principle and the basic motivation of that idea that I'll tell you in a second is the following, that really, when you're an SME and you want to license technologies because you are a licensee, because you're a product in the market, all you want to make sure is that you are going to be treated fairly, right? You're not going to be asked for royalties that are higher than what your larger competitors pay. You want to make sure that you're not being bullied by a large licensor. You want ways to figure out who you need to talk to and whether, once approached by a licensor, you're being treated fairly. So the idea that I had is, if Europe, the Commission wanted to do something useful for SMEs, could be maybe to set up, or maybe to enhance, or maybe to partner with a mediation center where an SME could use a seasoned mediator when approached by a licensor. A licensor could have the peace of mind of confidentiality through mediation to submit comparable licenses, and the mediator would basically give a yay or nay answer to the SME. You've been asked something fair in line with what your competitors are paying, or not, right? And that's an indication for an SME to move forward in an efficient way. I think that, to me, would be a more useful tool. I put myself in the shoe of an SME, not only because I run an SME, but also because there are a lot of SMEs who have that concern, right? And that could potentially be something useful. Again, not a full-fledged idea yet, but it's something that maybe we should think about. Does ADR has a role in this, rather than full-fledged regulation and databases that no one knows how they would function, and evaluation of essentiality that takes weeks and man hours to build, and so on.
That definitely does seem like a simpler, more elegant solution that actually solves myself the problem, if there is a problem, which I think is part of a debate, right? Whether this problem actually exists of these SMEs being approached by licensors. Because as we start out this discussion, from an efficiency standpoint, it doesn't really make much sense to spend your time on that.
I'll tell you an anecdote, right? I have a friend who has an IoT company. And some time ago, he got approached by a licensor. And he immediately picked up the phone and called me. "You got to help me. I don't know what to do. There is, why me? Why are they targeting me? What's going on? And how do I respond?" And so on and so forth. And my answer was like, "Well, my friend, first of all, calm down. Then go down to the cellar. Pick a good bottle, open it, and drink it, because you got to celebrate. Because if they approach you, it means you're doing something right. you're probably profitable. You're probably growing. You're probably in a position that actually you are on the radar, which means that you're doing something right. Because as you said, I mean, if you're so small that really you fly under the radar, from an efficiency point of view, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense for licensors to even spend the resources to approach you.
I want to kind of lean on your wisdom a little bit from all your experiences. Two questions, I guess, come to mind at the end. One is, I think you addressed some of the issues in terms of the pro-patent side about what not getting on the same side in patent policy debates. But if there's, let's say, a company or maybe even like a set of interests that want to push, maybe an SME like a convener that wants to push for influence policy in DC, what do you think is an effective way to do that? I guess what is anything that comes to mind?
Yeah, the problem that most smaller companies, including Convita right now, face is a matter of bandwidth and a matter of priorities, right? It's very difficult to prioritize the policy debate when you have limited budget, limited bandwidth, and you're actually trying to run the company, do the R&D, and potentially bring in money through licensing. So realistically, I think the only avenue is really to partner with someone and partner with other organizations, with like-minded organizations that can actually take your message to the Hill or wherever else, right? I don't think that there is a lot more that an SME can do. There have been examples of SMEs who have been directly very involved in the policy debate. Obviously, those are exceptions, but they're incredibly powerful. So to the extent that, SME CEOs of smaller companies are willing to and have the bandwidth to do so, testifying on the Hill, getting on panels, on policy discussions, I think that that's very, very helpful to set the record straight, right? To make sure that everyone understands that there are SMEs on both sides, there are SMEs that are both licensors and licensees, and that ultimately licensees do want a voice and don't want to be represented by, other organizations that don't really represent SMEs but represent bigger companies. Right?
Somebody listening to this podcast would learn a small part of your story about being really in the arena in terms of licensing innovation and on the policy fights. What advice would you give to someone who wants to be the next Matteo Sabatini?
Well, look at other examples that are much better. Policy and licensing licensing folks out there that you should take inspiration from. No, jokes aside, I mean, thanks. I take that as a huge compliment. I guess the only suggestion that I'm willing to give is that the patent board is an exciting environment and an environment where there is no perfect background, right? Because we deal with technology, we deal with the law, we deal with business, we deal with policy. And so you can come at it from very different angles, right? And it's definitely the debates that we're having on the policy side are very important for society, are very important for the economy, are very important for our industries. And so these are worthwhile debates to be having, and it's worth the time, and especially if you're passionate about innovation, it's worth looking at the debate a little closer. That's really the only recommendation I would give.
Thanks, Matteo, and thank you for your time.
Thanks, Ayla. It's great to be here.
Thank you for listening to Clause 8, the voice of IP. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with others and leave a 5-star rating in your favorite podcatcher. We'd also like to thank Harity & Harity LLP for their generous support. For more information, visit voiceofip.com. And don't forget to check out our full archive of past episodes. Clause 8 is a Brouhaha audio production. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.